Chapter 42. Turned towards it now from the fact that I could see it from my bedroom window and had been struck afresh by its uncouth, incongruous appearance. Isn't there some story connected with that stone? I asked. I remember that we always called it the Dead Stone as children. Alan cast a quick, sidelong glance in that direction, and his brows contracted in an irritable frown. I don't know, he answered shortly. They say that there is a woman buried beneath it, I believe. A woman buried there? I exclaimed in surprise. But who? How should I know? They know nothing whatever about it. The place is full of stupid traditions of that kind. Then, looking suspiciously round at me, why do you ask? I don't know, it was just something to say, I answered plaintively. His strange mood so worked upon my nerves that it was all that I could do to restrain my tears. I think that my tone struck his conscience, for he made a few feverish attempts at conversation after that. But they were so entirely abortive that he soon abandoned the effort, and we finished our walk to church as speechlessly as we had begun it. The service was bright, and the sermon perhaps a little commonplace, but sensible as it seemed to me in matter, and adequate in style. The peaceful evening hymn which followed, the short solemn pause of silent prayer at the end, soothed and refreshed my spirit. A hasty glance at my companion's face as he stood waiting for me in the porch, with the full light from the church streaming round him, assured me that the same influence had touched him too. Haggard and sad he still looked, it is true, but his features were composed, and the expression of actual pain had left his eyes. Silent as we had come, we started homeward through the waning moonlight, but this silence was of a very different nature to the other, and after a minute or two I did not hesitate to break it. It was a good sermon? I observed, interrogatively. Yes, he assented, I suppose you would call it so, but I confess that I should have found the text more impressive without its exposition. Poor man! But don't you often find it so? He asked. Do you not often wish, to take this evening's instance, that clergymen would infuse themselves with something of St. Paul's own spirit? Then perhaps they would not water all the strength out of his words, in their efforts to explain them. That is rather a large demand to make upon them, is it not? Is it? He questioned. I don't ask them to be inspired saints. I don't expect St. Paul's breadth and depth of thought, but could they not have something of his vigorous completeness, something of the intensity of his feeling and belief? Look at the text of tonight. Did not the preacher's examples and applications take something from its awful unqualified strength? Awful! I exclaimed, in surprise, that is hardly the expression I should have used in connection with those words. Why not? Oh, I don't know. The text is very beautiful, of course, and at times, when people are tiresome, and one ought to be nice to them, it is very difficult to act up to. But you think that awful is rather a big adjective, to use for so small a duty, interposed Alan, and the moonlight showed the flicker of a smile upon his face. Then he continued, gravely, I doubt whether you yourself realize the full import of the words. The precept of charity is not merely a code of rules by which to order our conduct to our neighbors. It is the picture of a spiritual condition, and such, where it exists in us, must by its very nature be roused into activity by anything that affects us. So with this particular injunction, every circumstance in our lives is a challenge to it, and in presence of all alike it admits of one attitude only. Beareth all things, endureth all things. Apostrophe I hope it will be long before that all sticks in your gizzard, Evie, before you come face to face with things which nature cannot bear, and yet which must be borne. He stopped, his voice quivering, and then after a pause went on again more calmly, and throughout it is the same. Moral precepts everywhere, which will admit of no compromise, no limitation, and yet which are at war with our strongest passions. If one could only interpret some unless, apostrophe some except, even and until, which should be short of the grave. But we cannot. The law is infinite, universal, eternal. There is no escape, no repose. Resist, strive, endure, that is the recurring cry, that is existence. And peace, I exclaimed, appealingly. Where is there room for peace, if that be true? He sighed for answer, and then in a changed and lower tone added, however thickly the clouds mass, however vainly we search for a coming glimmer in their midst, we never doubt that the sky is still beyond, beyond and around us, infinite and infinitely restful. He raised his eyes as he spoke, and mine followed his. We had entered the wooded glen. Through the scanty autumn foliage we could see the stars shining faintly in the dim moonlight, and beyond them the deep illimitable blue. A dark world it looked, distant and mysterious, and my young spirit rebelled at the consolation offered me. Peace seems a long way off, I whispered. It is for me, he answered, gently, not necessarily for you. Oh, but I am worse and weaker than you are. If life is to be all warfare, I must be beaten. I cannot always be fighting. Cannot you? Evie, what I have been saying is true of every moral law worth having, of every ideal of life worth striving after, that men have yet conceived. But it is only half the truth of Christianity. You know that. We must strive, for the promise is to him that overcometh. But though our aim be even higher than is that of others, we cannot in the end fail to reach it. The victory of the cross is ours. You know that? You believe that? Yes, I answered, softly, too surprised to say more. In speaking of religion he, as a rule, showed to the full the reserve which is characteristic of his class and country, and this sudden outburst was in itself astonishing. But the eager anxiety with which he emphasized the last words of appeal impressed and bewildered me still further. We walked on for some minutes in silence. Then suddenly Alan stopped, and turning, took my hand in his. In what direction his mind had been working in the interval I could not divine, but the moment he began to speak I felt that he was now for the first time giving utterance to what had been really at the bottom of his thoughts the whole evening. Even in that dim light I could see the anxious look upon his face, and his voice shook with restrained emotion. Evie, he said, have you ever thought of the world in which our spirits dwell, as our bodies do in this one of matter and sense, and of how it may be peopled? I know, he went on hurriedly, that it is the fashion nowadays to laugh at such ideas. I envy those who have never had cause to be convinced of their reality, and I hope that you may long remain among the number. But should that not be so, should those unseen influences ever touch your life, I want you to remember then, that, as one of the race for whom Christ died, you have as high a citizenship in that spirit land as any creature there. That you are your own soul's warden, and that neither principalities nor powers can rob you of that your birthright. I think my face must have shown my bewilderment, for he dropped my hand, and walked on with an impatient sigh. You don't understand me. Why should you? I dare say that I am talking nonsense only, his voice expressed such an agony of doubt and hesitation, that I burst out, I think, that I do understand you a little, Alan. You mean that even from unearthly enemies there is nothing that we need really fear at least, that is, I suppose, nothing worse than death. But that is surely enough. Why should you fear death? He said, abruptly, your soul will live. Yes, I know that, but still I stopped with a shudder. What is life after all but one long death, he went on, with sudden violence. Our pleasures, our hopes, our youth are all dying, ambition dies, and even desire at last. Our passions and tastes will die, or will live only to mourn their dead opportunity. The happiness of love dies with the loss of the loved, and, worst of all, love itself grows old in our hearts and dies. Why should we shrink only from the one death which can free us from all the others? It is not true, Alan. I cried, hotly. What you say is not true. There are many things even here which are living and shall live. And if it were otherwise, in everything, life that ends in death is better than no life at all. You say that, he answered, because for you these things are yet living. To leave life now, therefore, while it is full and sweet, untainted by death, surely that is not a fate to fear. Better, 1,000 times better, to see the cord cut with one blow, while it is still whole and strong, and to launch out straight into the great ocean, than to sit watching through the slow years, while strand after strand, thread by thread, loosens and unwinds itself, each with its own separate pang breaking, bringing the bitterness of death without its release. His manner, the despairing ring in his voice, alarmed me even more than his words. Clinging to his arm with both hands, while the tears sprang to my eyes, Alan, I cried, don't say such things, don't talk like that. You are making me miserable. He stopped short at my words, with bent head, his features hidden in the shadow thus cast upon them, nothing in his motionless form, to show what was passing within him. Then he looked up, and turned his face to the moonlight and to me, laying his hand on one of mine. Don't be afraid, he said. It is all right, my little David. You have driven the evil spirit away. And lifting my hand, he pressed it gently to his lips. Then drawing it within his arm, he went on, as he walked forward, and even when it was on me at its worst, I was not meditating suicide, as I think you imagine. I am a very average specimen of humanity, neither brave enough to defy the possibilities of eternity nor cowardly enough to shirk those of time. No, I was only trying idiotically to persuade a girl of 18 that life was not worth living, and more futilely still, myself, that I did not wish her to live. I am afraid that in my mind philosophy and fact have but small connection with each other. And though my theorizing for your welfare may be true enough, yet, I cannot help it, Evie, it would go terribly hard with me, if anything were to happen to you. His voice trembled as he finished. My fear had gone with his return to his natural manner, but my bewilderment remained. Why should there anything happen to me? I asked. That is just it, he answered, after a pause, looking straight in front of him, and drawing his hand wearily over his brow. I know of no reason why there should. Then giving a sigh, as if finally to dismiss from his mind a worrying subject, I have acted for the best, he said, and may God forgive me, if I have done wrong. There was a little silence after that, and then he began to talk again, steadily, and quietly. The subject was deep enough still, as deep as any that we had touched upon, but both voice and sentiment were calm, bringing peace to my spirit, and soon making me forget the wonder and fear of a few moments before. Very openly did he talk as we passed on across the long trunk shadows, and through the glades of silver light, and I saw farther then into the most sacred recesses of his soul than I have ever done before or since. When we reached home the moon had already set, but some of her beams seemed to have been left behind within my heart, so pure and peaceful was the light which filled it. The same feeling continued with me all through that evening. After dinner some of the party played and sang. As it was Sunday, and Lucy was rigid in her views, the music was of a sacred character. I sat in a low armchair in a dark corner of the room, my mind too dreamy to think, and too passive to dream. I hardly interchanged three words with Alan, who remained in a still darker spot, invisible and silent the whole time. Only as we left the room to go to bed, I heard Lucy ask him if he had a headache. I did not hear his answer, and before I could see his face he had turned back again into the drawing room. It was early, and when first I got to my room I felt little inclined for sleep. I wandered to the window, and drawing aside the curtains, looked out upon the still, starlit sky. At least I should rest quiet tonight. The air was very clear, and the sky seemed full of stars. As I stood there, scraps of schoolroom learning came back to my mind. That the stars were all suns, surrounded perhaps in their turn by worlds as larger than our own. Worlds beyond worlds, and others farther still, which no man might number or even descry. and about the distance of those wonderful suns to that one, for instance, at which I was looking. What was it that I had been told? That our world was not yet peopled, perhaps not yet formed, when the actual spot of light which now struck my sight first started from the star's surface. While it flashed along, itself the very symbol of speed, the whole of mankind had had time to be born, and live, and die. My gaze dropped, and fell upon the dim, half-seen outline of the dead stone. That woman who, while that one ray speeded towards me, her life had been lived and ended, and her body had rotted away into the ground. How close together we all were. Her life and mine, our joys, sufferings, deaths all crowded together into the space of one flash of light. And yet there was nothing there, but a horrible skeleton of dead bones, while I stopped with a shudder, and turned back into the room. I wished that Alan had not told me what lay under the stone. I wished that I had never asked him. It was a ghastly thing to think about, and spoiled all the beauty of the night to me. I got quickly into bed, and soon dropped asleep. I do not know how long I slept, but when I woke it was with the consciousness again of that haunting wind. It was worse than ever. The world seemed filled with its din. Hurling itself passionately against the house, it gathered strength with every gust, till it seemed as if the old walls must soon crash in ruins round me. Gust upon gust, blow upon blow, swelling. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.